And see where we go. As you probably know, in the Theravadin school of Buddhism, in many schools of Buddhism, but certainly in this school of Buddhism, there are a tremendous number of lists. Things are listed out everywhere, the five of these and the ten of those and the seven of those, and it seems to have been a memorization device for what was an oral tradition for many hundreds of years before things were actually written down. And so the faculty of investigation does appear on many of these lists. And there are indeed whole separate practices that emphasize investigation. But in addition to that, there's an aspect of mindfulness that is investigation. It's not the normal discursive investigation that we might be accustomed to. But it means a kind of keenness of attention that can see below the surface of what's going on. So the example I've been using again and again is if you, say, are angry, and you look at the anger to investigate it, you see it's not just one thing. There are these different strands woven together that together we are calling anger. But if we look at the different strands, we will see that they can be sensed or identified or known for what they are. When I was using this example once in a class I was teaching in terms of physical pain, and a friend of mine was in the class who was a musicologist, and he said, well, in music we would say, take apart the chord. So we are taking apart the cord of our suffering when we are investigating it. It doesn't mean trying to, you know, overanalyze it or deny the pain of it as we do a kind of cold analysis of it. It means really seeing its component parts, because that's seeing its very nature. Instead of feeling helpless and defeated and overcome by this massive, seemingly solid whatever, we take it apart. We come close to the different elements of it. We experience the spaciousness within it. And so that's what investigation means. We investigate the body, the mind, relationships. We investigate as a foundation for loving kindness, for example. Loving kindness, in that sense, doesn't mean an emotion or a sentiment or a kind of feeling, which I actually think limits us. It means an acknowledgement of connection, a sense of relatedness to all parts of ourselves and ultimately to all beings. So we might do an analysis, like what factors brought each of us to be together right now in this room. We have numbers who are here, but what if we also added the people who had each inspired us to become interested in meditation? The people who read us a poem or gave us a book or told us about their own experience in meditation. And what if they were all here too? And we just took a moment to reflect on that. And the people who'd hurt us really badly and maybe broken our hearts and challenged us to look for a deeper sense of happiness. You know, what if they were all here too? Maybe they are here. And, you know, the people who made the clothes that we're wearing and the people who grew the food that we ate today and the people who created this building and the people who serve the organization that is allowing this opportunity to happen. You know, what if our sense of being here together encompassed a much bigger picture like that? there would be a feeling tone of relatedness that's much bigger than the normal feeling we have of being so alone and on our own and kind of independent. It's not that we're not independent, but it's more that we're interdependent, and that any gathering such as this is a gathering of many, many forces, many people, many influences, many relationships, many ups and many downs, and so many things for each of us has brought us here. I mean, would we be here together right now if I hadn't gone to Buffalo, New York for college? You know, maybe not. So many things have propelled each of us to be here. That's a part of our being here together. It's that kind of investigation that's often done. You know, like in certain schools of Tibetan Buddhism, they hold up like this glass or this shirt, you know, and through that kind of analysis, or how many people were involved in the creation of the glass, and how many people were involved in the shipping of the glass, and how many people were, you know, involved in the purchasing of the glass, and the water, you know, what about the water? And, you know, it's like you get from a glass of water to the whole universe. And it's true. So that is the foundation for a kind of a perception of life which is loving kindness. You know, it's that feeling that, like it or not, we are inextricably bound to one another. It's like when I was here in the summer and I asked if there was a subway here, not knowing it was the hot political issue of Seattle. You know, innocently enough, I asked if there was a subway here. Using the example that my friend Bob Thurman had used in New York, saying, you know, imagine you were in a subway car with a whole bunch of other people, and these Martians come and they zap the subway car so that all of you are going to be stuck together forever. And I said, what do you do? If somebody's hungry, you feed them. If somebody's frightened, you comfort them, because you're going to be together forever. That's actually the sense, the sensibility of what loving kindness is. And we can come to that through that kind of understanding that's done through investigation of really looking, what is a life? What is one single life? Can it ever really be single, singular? And we say no. You know, everything we know is a combination of conditions coming together. Everything we are is a combination of conditions coming together. That's actually the nature of things. Do you have any other questions? And there's some more I'll get to this afternoon. Yeah. The question was about people talking about compassion as a feeling, right? And as opposed to kind of a connection to others. To some extent, I'm going to talk a lot about that this afternoon, so I'm kind of thinking, you know, about that. But just for now, you know, it's interesting because compassion, the translation of the word from Pali, karuna, is actually the trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to pain. So it's a movement of the heart. It is very relational. It's not just it's not just a sentiment or a thing we have, you know, or don't have. It's really a movement, it's a responsiveness. But often what we're also faced with is a kind of feeling of helplessness about actually doing something effective that will ease someone's suffering. And so this we'll talk about this afternoon. Is that our hand up? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the question was about what I was talking about earlier about how sometimes mindfulness magnifies a difficult emotion. And I was using the example of having enough space or creating enough spaciousness so that that really difficult energy can move through. But her experience is that that intensification often takes the form of a kind of constriction. So how do you handle that? Well, I mean, sometimes we say this is the easiest thing in the world to teach because you only ever say one thing. You know, you just figure out different ways of saying it. You know, then the constriction becomes the object of meditation. And you have to, if you can, step back from that and notice it without identifying with it. Because so many of these experiences draw us in, especially in self-judgment. Like, I'm so uptight, I can't handle anything, you know, or certainly yesterday it was better than today, I'm getting worse. And it's very difficult to let go and allow a process to unfold. And when I was talking about being on the elevator carrying the very heavy suitcase in my arms and then having to put it down, I think it was experiences like that that led me actually to want to write a book on a topic like faith, which is a peculiar topic, really. Often from the Buddhist sense, it's not something that is so often talked about. It's a word that is so controversial, and so many people, especially when I first started talking about wanting to write the book, you know, would either laugh or be angry or confused, because it was a word so laden with so many associations about blind adherence to a dogma or loss of self-respect or just surrendering to someone else's vision of what's true. But I mean more in that sense when we can put the suitcase down, when we have a sense of, I'm not in control, I'm going to hang in there, I'm going to see what happens. It's that sense we have of entering a mystery that really is meditation. It's spiritual life is a mystery. It's not so linear that we can say, well, you know, my anger is going to be diminished every 3 days by this percent until it's gone. You know, that's not what our experience is. Sometimes it's stronger. Sometimes we see it more clearly. There are a lot of things that are confusing if we're incessantly trying to judge, you know, or check on our progress. It takes some kind of letting go and letting things unfold. And so in a sense, it's very hard to do. It's easier to say than to do, but, you know, the less personally we can take something, the better off we are. And so you feel that kind of constriction. That's what you're looking at. You know, if you can step back from that, let that be there. Understand that as a combination of conditions. You know, and just see what happens. I tell the story sometimes about how some years ago some friends took me to Grace Cathedral in San Francisco to walk the labyrinth. And it was both an indoor labyrinth where the preset pattern was on a rug, and then an outdoor labyrinth where it was this identical pattern but on these like granite blocks. And the goal, of course, in the labyrinth is to start at the edge and just follow it along as it twists and turns until you get to the very center. And so this was the first time I'd ever done it, and I was starting on the edge, and I walked and walked and walked, and I was almost in the very center of the rug inside. When, strangely enough, the path took this funny turn, and I found myself way back again at the edge, and I thought, I must have made a mistake. But it's like, there's nothing to do but keep going, you know, step by step. And so I kept going, and I found, much to my surprise, that starting at the edge and finding myself almost in the very middle, that the path took me way out to the edge and then right back into the very center. So I did that, and then I went right away outside to walk the identical pattern on the granite blocks. And I had the identical experience, right down to being on the edge, being almost in the center, being taken out to the edge again, and having the thought, oh, I must have made a mistake. And then I thought, wait a minute, didn't you just do this like, you know, like 3 minutes ago, you were inside, you had this experience, you saw, you know, that sometimes you just have to keep going. You just have to keep going, and then there you are. But it's not a kind of dull-witted keeping on going, you know, like, you know, oppressed and unable to make a change. It's not like that. It really is that quality of faith. That we have a sense, maybe it's not a full sense, it's just some kind of inner knowing that we are doing the right thing, that we're doing the best we can, that we're carrying on, and that we need to give things time. Things are going to unfold in their own way. We can't control it. We have to just be with it. And that's really very much in that sense. It would be, conventionally speaking, very disappointing, you know, to look at anger one day and have it nicely dissolve into bubbles, you know, and look at it the next day and have, you know, layer upon layer of tension come into it. But sometimes it's like that. Maybe here, yeah. The question was about practicing being with just one breath and then noticing a lot of fear about letting go into the breath, you know, and the anxiety and the worry. And, it's like having to let go of those and just be there with it. And I think that's also a very natural experience. You know, I think that for all that I was so funny when I first started practicing about feeling, well, this is a stupid technique, you know, it's so simple. Anybody could do this. It's not easy to do for all of those reasons. You know, it was very hard to be with one breath because, like I said, as soon as this breath would begin, I would be leaning forward for the next one, you know, trying to get ready, or I'd be tense as though I'd never done it before. And what you're describing is also very common. You know, it happens for many people that we find that we have quite a bit of difficulty just letting it be, letting it go. It is like putting that suitcase down where it would be a great relief, but it doesn't occur to us right away. And some practices actually emphasize the observation of the out-breath for that very reason, because there's a kind of release that happens as we do that. And that could be something that you just, you know, pay particular attention to. And sometimes it'd be hard. You know, you feel resistance and tension and uncertainty and all of that. And you kind of have to make room for all of those things and see, okay, that's okay that they're there. Because if you start to do battle with them, then you'll just be very tense instead of a little tense, you know. And so it's not worth it. But to, you know, recognize all of those feelings and just breathe out.
When you say juncture, you spoke, I don't remember exactly. with what I've done with this test, but we talked about some teachers who have said something like, why do you set your sights so low? Talking about faith and the practice with the intent of liberation. Could you speak some to that again?
Yeah, I'm going to talk a little bit about that this afternoon too, but the comment was about when I was here last summer and I was talking about one of my teachers who is a Tibetan teacher, Nyeshal Ken Rinpoche, who would emphasize a lot our tendency, our collective tendency, and certainly my tendency, to have a very limited sense of aspiration. And he would often comment to his students how we might each, as you said, set our sights very low and have just a very limited sense of what we are capable of as human beings. And this is in direct contrast to the Buddhist teaching, where the Buddha himself is always depicted as a human being and as an exemplar of what a human being can be, which is someone with, you know, infinite compassion and infinite wisdom and so on. And certainly in the Theravadan tradition of Buddhism, in which I was trained and found in Southeast Asia, countries like Burma and Thailand, where they talk a lot about the Buddha as a human being and the fact that he developed what he developed, the qualities he developed through the power of his own awareness, and so can we. So what Kenpo, as he was known, Nyeshal Ken Rinpoche, was saying was that in effect he would say, why not aspire to be a fully liberated being for the sake of all beings? He'd say, why not? And that, I think, is also part of the investigation we make, either consciously or just intuitively, as we pursue spiritual life. It's like, why not? You know, what is it that makes me think that I can do so little, or I can try for so little, or I can accomplish so little? Like, why? What is that? And, you know, you don't have to do psychoanalysis, but you can feel it. You know, you feel the lack of intention, or you feel the belittling of oneself. You know, there's so many things that become apparent as we look within, and it's a really good question, like, why not? You know, the barriers or the boundaries are artificial constructs that are born out of our conditioning. And, you know, I sometimes say, if I'm remembered at all in the annals of Buddhism in the West, which I suppose I will be, it will be for the one conversation I had with His Holiness the Dalai Lama some years ago when I was in India at a conference, just a small conference with him and some psychotherapist and a philosopher. And the topic of the conference was emotions and health, and I had the opportunity to ask him a question, and so the Dalai Lama, and so I said to him, Your Holiness, what do you think about self-hatred? And he said to me, what is that? And I said, well, I was kind of stymied, and he was absolutely confused. And he couldn't understand. He looked at us and he said, is that some kind of nervous disorder? And then people like that, are they very violent? And I mean, he didn't understand, you know, and so the psychotherapist, of course, chimed in and said, well, it's probably everybody in the room, and, you know, and just like, it was a whole thing, and he just couldn't. And his translators were trying really hard to explain it, and he was just sitting there, like, and finally he said something like, but you have Buddha nature, you know, from the perspective of the teachings, we all have that same capacity, like a seed inside of us, that the Buddha had to develop, to nurture, to cultivate, if we will, that will flower into that kind of mind and heart that the Buddha had. We all have Buddha nature. We all have that same potential from birth, innately, for that much compassion and that much wisdom. So the Dalai Lama was sitting there saying, but you have Buddha nature. How can you think so little of yourself? And it's like, it just didn't compute at all, you know. So it's a whole other way of perceiving our basic nature. And so it's based on that conception that somebody like Nyeshe Ken Rinpoche would say, why not, you know? Like, why not aspire to that kind of greatness of being, that we really can. We can do that. We may not, you know, for any number of reasons, but in terms of having the potential, we absolutely can. Did you have a question? Yeah. Mm-hmm. The question was about, when we talk about mindfulness and being in the moment, how do we then make decisions and plans, which would involve the future? And mostly, you know, we think of planning as an activity that's happening right now, as a thought in the mind, and we try to be mindful of it, not to dismiss it, because obviously we have to make plans, you know. But in order to have enough time and enough space to understand the different components that are going into wanting to make that plan. So, you know, the example I used yesterday of when I was planning on staying in India for the rest of my life, you know, there was a lot of anxiety and insecurity and fear and things that were really affecting the nature of that planning. And it was just kind of incessant planning. It wasn't really doing anything. And what I needed to do was kind of come back to what was really going on in the moment, in order to have a clearer sense of direction. You know, so we plan. I'm sure Rodney planned what to make me for lunch today, you know, and he had to go buy it and do all of these things, and that's life. That's how we do it. But really trying to have an anchor in the moment and realizing that plan is just a thought happening right now in the mind, in one's mind, and that we move based on certain directions that planning indicates, but we also need to stay aware of what is happening in the moment, and to have a sense of comprehension as things change, because they do. Not to let the planning become that effort to seize control of that which we'll never be able to control. You know, just kind of watch it as a thought and see where it takes you. Okay, the question was about, start at the end, that when he goes on retreat, it feels like things happen or something moves or something is accomplished, but on a day-to-day basis, not much happens. There are a few levels to that. One is the old labyrinth level, you know, it was like sometimes you just have to keep going because it is a mystery. Sometimes it feels like we're just plodding along and then something happens. And we might think disdainfully of all those hours where it seemed like nothing was happening, but really they're all connected. It is like laying the stage, setting the stage for something else to emerge, and we just have to go through it. And sometimes it's not going to be so instantly gratifying all the time, but we have to do it. The other thing is we have to do it. And there's a very big difference between thinking about meditating and meditating, you know, or talking about meditating or writing books about meditating and meditating. And, you know, one of the peculiar circumstances of my own background and training, given that I did virtually all of my early practice and quite a bit of my later practice in Asia, was that most of the teachers I studied with, until I studied with Upandita, were lay people. You know, they weren't monks or nuns. They were people who had families or jobs and families or circumstances that are, for most of us, a little more concurrent with how we live. You know, that's how we live, most of us. And I saw right away, you know, that they were extraordinary beings who were tremendous inspirations to me, and they had real lives. You know, and so somehow they managed to make those real lives that look, you know, kind of like mine, into a very effective vehicle for transformation. And I think of this one woman teacher I had named Deepa Ma, who was an amazing woman who, you know, had an enormous amount of suffering in her life in many different ways, including losing two of her children and her husband. And she got into meditation, they say, when she was living in Burma, because her husband, who had died suddenly, had been in the civil service there. And she was absolutely grief-stricken and ended up going to bed, just incapable of functioning. And the doctor came to see her and said, you know, you're actually going to die of a broken heart unless you do something about your mind. And it being Burma, he said, you should go learn how to meditate. And so she did. You know, she got up and she went to the retreat center to learn how to meditate. And she, through her practice, transformed that horrible grief and suffering into this amazing compassion. And she exemplified that, you know, throughout the rest of her life. When I met her, she was living in Calcutta with her daughter in this tiny little room, this horrible, wretched area. And she was kind, she was generous, she was amazing, you know, and she used the circumstances of her life every day, not just the terrible circumstances that had first inspired her to practice, but every day, what it was. And, you know, it's easy to say, you know, we can use anything, but we really can. And it's really a question of doing the best we can without attachment to the fruit of the action, because we don't know how it will manifest or when, but it's the intensity and the commitment and the dedication of really doing it, really using our time. And for most people, that means trying to sit every day. Because, well, theoretically, and it's true, you know, we can be mindful eating, we can be mindful taking a walk, we can be mindful taking a shower. For most of us, we're not gonna, you know, we're just not. Unless we have a dedicated period where that's all it's about. And for one thing, it's humbling, you know, to... when I first went to India, and I was had been a student, and I'd studied Buddhism in college, you know, so I'd done term papers and karma and all these theories. And so I went with, amongst the other things going on in my mind at the time, a certain feeling like, oh, I really know what Buddhism is about. And then I got there and then finally entered that intensive 10-day retreat. And it didn't take probably 15 minutes, you know, to realize I didn't know anything about Buddhism, you know. Like, it's one thing to talk about pain and pleasure and emptiness and impermanence. And it's another thing was my knee pain, you know, and it hurts and I'm afraid. And, you know, so if nothing else, to drop down to that level of a direct and immediate experience of what is true for us. It's very important to try to sit every day. And even if it feels like nothing is happening, something is happening. And so it's like the primary commitment, which will really help us. You know, and then you can just be gracious about putting the... Then you're on the elevator, in effect. You know, then you can put the suitcase down And let it unfold however it does, because it's going to be mysterious. From the Buddhist point of view, usually we say that an action we do in the world, whether it's saying something or doing something, can be seen in three aspects. And actually, I want to talk about four. The first aspect is our perception, our vision, our understanding, our wisdom. It's how we see the world. How we see the world will affect the choices that we make, the things we choose to act on, the things we choose not to. And so here is the whole kind of thrust of meditation practice, is how do we see ourselves? How do we see our capacities? How do we see our potential? How do we see our connection to others? How do we see our responsibility in the world? How do we see life? The more we concentrate, the more mindful we are, the more aware we are, the more we open, it's believed, the more accurately, the more truthfully we'll see life. We'll see the nature of the body. We'll see the nature of the mind. We'll see the nature of the connection between the body and the mind. We'll see how interrelated we all are. So that isn't a question of pondering it or contemplating it or trying to convince yourself of it. It actually becomes a question of perception. So sometimes I use the example of driving down a road in Massachusetts in the autumn and having a car going in front of me very, very slowly and being quite irate until I pull out to pass the car and look over and I see that there are two very elderly people in the car really enjoying the leaves of autumn. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, this object, which had been the object of my ire, you know, like, can't you go a little faster, become my teacher. I go, oh, yeah. That'd be a good idea. Actually, why not enjoy the leaves? The way I see the occupants of that car really affect how I'm relating to it, the decisions I make, and so on. And so it's taught always in Buddhist schools that if we really knew who we were, we would discover within us those capacities for awareness, for love, for connection, that are unvanquished, undestroyed, no matter what we've been going through, no matter what we may yet go through. As capacities in everybody, those are present. And they can't be destroyed. They can't be annihilated by anything. They may be something we're out of touch with, something that is obscured, something we don't trust, but they are there as capacities. And I used to hear that, and I used to think, no way. You know, I mean, look at the world. It's a mess, you know. How could one possibly believe that these capacities are an innate part of one's being? And then I did this little experiment, which was along the lines of investigation or analysis. I really looked at how I was relating to myself in different situations and looked at how I was relating to others in different situations. And I realized that there had never actually, not once, been a time when I understood myself more clearly in terms of what had guided me to act a certain way, or what had impelled me to act a certain way, what were the conditions surrounding that action. There had never once been a time when I understood myself more clearly and loved myself less or had less compassion. And in fact, there had never been a time when I'd understood someone else more clearly, with more insight, more comprehension, more sense of context from which they had taken a certain action, and had less compassion for them. So then I began to think, well, if seeing clearly will bring me to a certain way of being, and insight will bring me to that way of being, and opening to a deeper truth will bring me to that way of being, maybe that is more the natural state of the mind, in fact, It's a question of not seeing clearly, not understanding that is our problem. So vision or view, understanding is very fundamental. And then in terms of the action we take, the first phase or aspect of that is the intention or the motivation that will bring forth the action. And it's how we see the world that will give rise to certain intentions or motives. And this in Buddhist teaching is considered like an absolutely crucial element of any action that we take, because it's in the intention or the motivation that the energy really is. It's said classically that this is where the karmic seed is. Because any action can be born of many, many, many different things inside someone. It's also taught, interestingly, that only we can know our own intention. We might guess it's somebody else's or be very sensitive and guess pretty well, but really we can only know our own intention. And we can know our intention. We can practice awareness or mindfulness. We can come close to our own experience. We can know when we're angry rather than 3 days later saying, oh, that's why I, you know, sent that letter. We can really come close in the moment to what we're going through and what is motivating us. And it's taught we can completely transform the field of our motivation. If, in general, the space from which we act is born of fear, and we do a practice like loving kindness, it's geared right to that arena of our motivations. In general, we will no longer come from fear, but we will come from a place of confidence, of connection, of trust in the nature of love. That's what happens when we do that practice. The motivation is really essential, because therein really lies the heart energy of the action. You know, if I had a book here and I reached forward to give it to one of you, there's so many different places inside of me that action could be coming from. I could be giving it to you because you have a book I want. And I think, well, hey, you know, I'll give you this book. Maybe you'll give me that book. Or I could be giving you the book because I'm sitting here in front of a room full of people and I want everyone to think I'm very generous. Or I could be giving it to you because I like you and I want you to have the book. Or I am really hoping the book will help you. There's so many different places inside. All anyone sees is my hand moving down and picking up an object and moving it forward. But that's not where the real energy is. The energy is in the motivation. And that's why it's really essential and powerful to know where we are coming from, what our intention is. It really makes for the action. And that is a realm, as I said, that we can completely transform. The second element of the action is the skillfulness or unskillfulness with which we act. And this means having mindfulness in a bigger context. It means paying attention to where we are. You know, maybe out of a beautiful motivation, I want to give one of you this book. But I stop a moment. I think, well, you know, it's only one book and there's a whole lot of people here. Maybe this is the kind of thing that's best done privately, by taking you aside and doing it in a different way. It means being sensitive. It means to develop skillfulness means being sensitive. It means learning from our mistakes. It means accepting feedback. It means really developing skill as best we can. So we have to pay attention. Now, what's interesting about these two is that a certain motivation doesn't define what is skillful in a particular situation. That's a question of wisdom or discernment or understanding. People often say, well, I don't know about developing a loving or compassionate heart, because then I'll just be completely complacent. I'll let myself be hurt. And abused and I won't do anything, I'll just kind of smile, you know, and say, well, I'm developing love, so I better just not do anything, or I'll let other people be hurt or abused or oppressed and I won't do anything. But the motivation of love or compassion or whatever does not limit our field of action to some tiny little stream, you know, that in our minds is associated with being sweet or being good. The skillfulness or the unskillfulness of the action is going to be determined by wisdom, by insight, by doing the best that we can with what we understand to be the situation, the context. And that's very important, you know, because that fear or that squeamishness about caring, about having compassion, thinking that it will make us weak, it will make us foolish, it will make us just give in and be apathetic. I think that is, it's always troublesome, but it's particularly troublesome perhaps for our time, you know, when people tend to feel so helpless and feel so overcome with fear. To understand that there will be many avenues of action available to us, the more we understand, the more we pay attention. And that what we have to do is really work on transforming our motives and work on learning how to pay attention so that we can do the best that we can. Then the third aspect of the action is what seems to be the immediate result, or sometimes in Buddhist teaching, it's talked about as praise and blame, but it's not just limited to praise and blame. It's what seems to have happened from the act. And here is the place where we really have entered that sense of mystery. You know, it might be that out of a beautiful motivation, I decide to give one of you the book and think about really carefully, and I figure out this incredibly sensitive, wonderful way of giving you the book, and I take you aside and I give you the book, but you know, just now in the walking period you used your cell phone and found out you won $10 million in the lottery. You could not care less about getting this book. You know, and you kind of smile a little frigidly, you know, and then you kind of walk away. Now, what does that mean about the quality of my heart? What does that mean about my gift? What does it mean about my generosity? Nothing. But it's the place or it's the way that we tend to land our sense of integrity, of who we are, how well we've done. And yet it's the very arena that we have no control over whatsoever. You know, what are you going to do? Say to somebody, well, at 3:50, I want you to come into the room. Something is going to happen. I don't want you to make any calls. I don't want you to check your email. I don't want you to talk to anybody, and I don't want you to think of anything, you know, that might be weighing on your mind. I want you to come in a totally blank slate so this thing can happen. I mean, life isn't like that. Every moment is a combination of conditions coming together. And so what we really need to do is act out of the best motive that we can with the greatest amount of skillfulness that we can, and then have some balance, which is equanimity. Because we will never be able to control the complete unfolding of events. And often it's a mystery anyway. I mean, how many times, I've certainly had this experience, I'm sure you have too, have you done something or said something to somebody and it seemed to have no effect whatsoever, only to have them come later and say, you know, that time you gave me that book 5 years ago, I put it aside, I didn't read it, meant nothing to me, but, you know, I just lost my job, or my father just got really sick, he's in the hospital, and you know what, I picked up the book, and all of a sudden, those few pages, even that I read 5 years ago, that meant nothing to me, all of a sudden it had a different resonance for me. There's so many times when that kind of thing happens. Over and over again. Sometimes we know and sometimes we don't know. But I often thought of the Buddha's teaching about this as a way to reclaim a sense of integrity and not to be so completely subject to the winds of change. The person got better right away or they didn't. Situation unblocked or it didn't. I got what I wanted or I didn't. And it's not that equanimity in that sense means not caring, because of course we care as human beings. But how much do we care? Do we care so much that we forget the nature of our motive, the power of our motive, the power of action, when it doesn't seem to yield an immediate and desired result? And we might, you know, but that's very painful. Really, to take sustained action to try to make a difference to ourselves, to somebody else, means that we need that kind of balance. It's the openness of really seeing how things are. That in life, anyone's life, there's pleasure and pain and gain and loss and praise and blame and fame and disrepute. There is nobody who has a life that is only pleasant and has no pain. It's just not in the nature of things. And rather than feeling despair, as one might at that, the understanding of that can open us to be able to give in a way that is sustainable, is enduring. And I talked about my teacher Deepa Ma, who had gone through such terrible suffering in her life. And it was always a quandary to me looking at people like her, because certainly everybody suffers to some degree or another. And not everybody emerges from it with that kind of love and compassion and interest in other beings. I have had another friend who died not too long ago, who was a Tibetan nun named Ani Pachen. And a book was actually written about her as well. Actually, somebody just put together a book about Deepa Ma. It's a world of books. But Ani Pachen's book is called Sorrow Mountain, and it's her story of having been basically like a princess in eastern Tibet, and her father was a local chieftain and led armies against the Chinese occupation when that happened, and then when he died, she led the armies, and then she was imprisoned for 21 years and went through torture and all kinds of hideous experiences, and then after 21 years, she was let out, and she escaped to India and became a nun. And then when we were creating the book about her, she came to the States and was going through interviews, and at one point she was staying in my house, and I remember coming down to breakfast, and she was making breakfast, and she would look at me and say, "Do you have enough tea? Don't you want more tea?" And I thought, boy, if I've been in prison for 21 years, would I really care if somebody else had another cup of tea? But she did. You know, it's just that kind of interest, that sense of care, of not excluding anybody. That's what's possible. It's not easy, but it's possible. When we realize this is in the nature of things, and that our suffering can be transformed if we don't allow it to have us feel completely isolated and alone and cut off, because it is in fact something that we all share. That's a kind of equanimity, which doesn't mean not caring, but it's having this big, big picture. Look at what we share. We don't like to look at what we share because it's scary, and it's also not what we're taught. But isn't this the nature of things? I always used to wonder, like when I went to India and I started practicing, how all of my teachers, being Buddhists, talked about suffering all the time. And they were like the happiest people I'd ever seen. And I thought, that doesn't compute, you know? It's like, they're certainly smiling enough and laughing enough, and it seemed genuine. But they kept saying, hey, look at this, you know, open to this, acknowledge this. Because therein lies the freedom. When we relate to it in a certain way. And that's also the power of loving kindness, of compassion, of sympathetic joy, and of equanimity, is to weave our lives into a much greater whole. So that as we go up and we go down, both, we realize that we're not alone. That we live connected to one another in this bigger picture of life. We act from the best motivation that we can. We act as skillfully as we can. And we can also let go because we can trust that bigger picture of life. That what we do will ripple out in ways that we may not be able to see for a long time or ever in this lifetime. We actually can trust that. That is also in the nature of things. That our actions count for something. And that we need to do the best that we can. And that's something that I have very strong faith in. That what we do really makes a difference. It's just not always on our timetable and according to our particular vision. Said that of those four Brahma-viharas, equanimity is the one that allows the other three to be boundless, because otherwise, without that kind of balance of saying, you know, life is as it is, then our metta, our loving kindness, can be what somebody once termed metta with an edge. And I often teach loving kindness retreats. I teach one in Barrie every February, for example. And all day long, a person will be doing the meditation, which we're about to do, which is the repetition of certain phrases that are the heart's expression, like, may I be happy, or may you be happy, something like that. And now sometimes people will leave a retreat, and then I'll run into them, probably in New York City, and they'll say something like, hey, you know, I spent all week offering love to my friend, and then I got out of retreat and I ran into them, and they're no better than they were before, you know, and I resent that. But it's very easy to do. It's said that equanimity gives loving kindness patience. I mean, if you're really in it for the long haul, you're in it for the long haul. And things take time, and we don't know a lot. It said that equanimity endows compassion with courage, because it's not easy. If the proximate cause or nearest arising condition for compassion is opening to suffering, it's not easy to actually open and not be overcome, not be shattered. Many years ago, Joseph and I went to what was then the Soviet Union to teach, and we went surreptitiously as tourists because it was actually illegal to do something like teach meditation. In fact, when I was just leaving Barrie, I was in the hallway, in the main hallway, and somebody came up to me and said, well, you have to be really careful when you're there, because I have a friend who went to Cuba to teach meditation, and they got arrested, and they're in jail. And I thought, thank you, you know. It's quite a nice bon voyage message. We went there as part of this tour group, and we never went to see anything. But we went to people's living rooms, and we were just teaching meditation and talking, and I was talking a lot about compassion, and every time I said the word, I would feel this really funny feeling in the room. And so finally, I took the translator aside and I said, when I say compassion, what do you say? And he described the state of, he said, I talk about how you're just shattered by the pain and you're overcome by it and broken by it, and it's like someone has taken a giant stake and driven it through your heart. And I thought, well, no wonder, you know, I had this really funny feeling. But we can feel that way too, and it's easy to get there because suffering can be overwhelming. But then where is the energy going to come from to actually try to make a difference? It's not there. We're broken, we're depleted, we're overcome. To actually have the energy means some ability to connect, to have some kind of balance, which doesn't mean not caring. But it's the perspective of wisdom. A few years ago, the Dalai Lama came to New York City and he gave some teachings in this theater and then gave a public talk in Central Park. And he's actually coming back next September and doing the same thing, same theater in Central Park. And a friend of mine organized the whole thing, and her real concern was about Central Park, was about how many people are going to show up for his talk in Central Park. And she tried to make it, it was free, it was, there's no registration or anything, and she just wanted it to be this really big gathering. And the day before it happened, it was pouring rain. It just rained and rained and rained and rained. So we all thought, oh well, there goes that idea. But that day, the Sunday that he was speaking, it actually didn't rain. We got up in the morning and went to the park, and I couldn't see anything, but I could hear the sound of Tibetan chanting happening in the distance. So I just walked toward the sound, and at one point I turned a corner and there was a sea of people. The State Department, which provided the security, told my friend that they estimated about 250,000 people. It was just everywhere the eye could land, there were people. All of us gathered there together to hear him. And when he finally started speaking, he opened with a statement that I found quite startling. He said, you know, from a certain point of view, I haven't had such an easy life. He said, I had to assume temporal power when I was 16. I had to flee into exile in my early 20s. I've had to lead a community in exile, trying to keep it alive. I've had to daily hear reports of the kind of suffering that is going on inside of Tibet. He said, it hasn't been such an easy life. And then he said, but I'm pretty happy. And of course, that's what one sees when you see him. He's pretty happy. And he went on to say, I mean, obviously it's not happy like happy-go-lucky or oblivious or just living in a dream world. He said, I'm pretty happy because of the force of compassion. When I meet somebody, I feel like they're not a stranger. I feel like we are somehow joined together. He said, it's because of the force of compassion that I feel pretty happy, because it unites me with so many people. It was so amazing a statement to me, because I bet that many of the 250,000 people sitting there could have said, hasn't been such an easy life. And not that many could have said, but I'm pretty happy. You know, there's something about that. Like, where does that sense of abundance come from that has us believe we can give something? It doesn't come from external circumstance. And if you just take material giving as an example, it comes from how we see the world. It comes from some view, a view of connection to others and a view of some kind of internal abundance. And I've certainly had the experience, maybe most markedly living in Asia and in Burma, a country like Burma, where when you go on retreat, you don't pay anything at all, because everything you need is provided by the people. Now, Burma is one of the poorest countries in the world, and yet every morsel of food you take there is provided by somebody, a person or a family or a whole village will come together In Burma, you don't get gifts on your birthday. You give gifts on your birthday. So things like somebody's birthday or when somebody's died, they're all commemorated at the monastery where people will come to feed people. You know, and amazingly poor people would be so generous. And then they'd come back here. And there'd be so much, relatively speaking. And so many times people didn't have that internal feeling that they had anything to give. It's how we view the world. It's how we view ourselves and our own capacity. And it's how we view our connection to others. A few years ago, I was very sick with bronchitis, which wouldn't go away through many relapses. And I finally started getting better, and I was living in New York City. And I was walking down the street one day when I heard a woman's voice saying, "I've been really sick all winter, and I'm finally getting better." So I was naturally intrigued, and I turned around. And there was this woman giving a whole bunch of money to this street person. And she went on to say, "I've had pneumonia many times this winter, and I finally am starting to get better, and I just wanted to share the joy." And I thought, look at that. I just walked right by that guy. You know, I've been really sick all winter too. Never occurred to me to share the joy with him. And I thought, well, should I go back? Should I give him some money? You know, I said, this is really your lucky day, you know. You know, I don't know what to do. And the point is, it isn't always appropriate to give money either. I mean, that's a question of discernment and evaluation to the best of one's understanding of what might be skillful. But it's that basic world view that this person's life had something to do with hers. That's what's really important. That's what's critical, actually. That will give rise to motivations that are wholesome or appropriate or skillful. And that will give rise to the wish to act in a skillful way, however that is discerned to be at that particular circumstance. It's what's really important for us, is having that sense. And it's not just material generosity. All of the giving of our hearts, our energy, is about generosity. All of those practices of loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy are about generosity. Many times people will say to me when we do the practice, one of the categories that we offer loving kindness to is a benefactor, somebody who's been really good to us or inspires us. Many times people will say to me, well, I chose the Dalai Lama as my benefactor, but then I felt really weird. It's like, what could I give to him? He doesn't need me. You know, we don't know that. And also, it's the same old thing. It's the same kind of self-judgment or feeling that what we are giving, what we have to offer, could never be good enough. So if we think of our work in the world or our efforts in the world, our being in the world, all as a kind of generosity, then we can understand when something is freely given. We can understand when it's a question of kind of handing over the book and waiting for the smile, and feeling overcome when it doesn't happen in the way that we want. We have a very broad view of what it's like to try to make a difference, and also have a very real sense of the nature of things in life. That we aspire, we offer, we try, and we need to do all that with wisdom. Let's sit together. We'll do some loving kindness and we'll close.